From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And we begin the week that Surgeon General Jerome Adams says will be the worst in many Americans' lives, their Pearl Harbor, as deaths from the coronavirus rise.
And racing to prevent more deaths, people making vaccines. Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine say when tested on mice, theirs produced antibodies that successfully fought off the coronavirus. They're hoping for human trials in a few weeks and a sped-up process to get a vaccine sooner than the year and a half it usually takes. Dr. Louis Phalo co-authored the study. Dr. Phalo, welcome.
Thank you.
We want to make some distinctions. We've spoken to researchers at the company Moderna. They're working on a vaccine that uses messenger RNA. This is the part of a cell that delivers information from DNA. They've hijacked it and put in a copy of the coronavirus so that a body will build up antibodies to that. We also spoke to researchers in Texas working on a vaccine that uses the actual antibodies of people who have survived COVID-19, extracts that for a vaccine. How would your vaccine work?
The PIT-COVAX vaccine is a simple subunit protein vaccine. So this is much like some of the flu vaccines that are already on the market. Basically, we use as an antigen a very small protein sequence taking from an important protein on the virus, which is essential for the virus to enter cells. The idea is that we will create an antibody response that blocks that protein on the surface of the virus so that it can't enter cells, kind of like blocking a lock and key.
Right. So you are using the same theory. You're trying to trick the body into creating antibodies and to fight off the virus.
Correct. So we hope to be able to deliver this antigen in a way that will result in the production of antibodies that are very specific for the virus that will prevent it from entering cells. And so that will prevent the actual infection.
And how is it delivered? Is it a shot?
Yeah. So the PIT-COVAX vaccine is not a shot. So it's delivered using a novel device that's known as a microneedle array. So you can think of a microneedle array sort of like a Band-Aid patch, with the exception that it has hundreds of very small microscopic needles. Mm-hmm. For the arrays we're using, the needles are made up of a sugar-like substance that rapidly dissolves when exposed to any moisture. So what we have done is integrated the antigen into this dissolvable matrix of the needles so that the needles are actually the antigen. Because of that, when we put this Band-Aid-like patch on the skin, the dry, hard needles are able to penetrate the upper layers of the skin. They then absorb moisture, and in minutes they dissolve and release the antigen very specifically into a specific area of the skin.
It's been described as having a piece of Velcro pressed against you.
That's what it feels like. So the needles are small enough that they don't reach nerves and they don't reach blood vessels. So there's no bleeding and there's no pain when these MNAs are applied.
Okay, so a couple things that you see as benefits. This vaccine doesn't have to be frozen when stored or transported. And it isn't the actual virus.
Correct. So there's no virus in this vaccine. It's a safe protein. This type of vaccine has been shown for other pathogens to be very safe, for example, the flu vaccine. It also is important, I think, that microneedle arrays are very stable at room temperature. So there's no need for the cold chain.
And this came out of research that you already did on similar coronaviruses, SARS, MERS. What are your questions? Because, yes, it sounds terrific and we're all very excited about it, but the new coronavirus, we know so little about. What are the concerns that you feel still need to be worked out?
So whenever you're trying to extrapolate from any animal model into humans, you face a fairly large gap. And so none of us are going to know how effective our vaccines are until we get them into human clinical trials. Now, the very good news is, as you mentioned earlier, there are multiple vaccine approaches being developed at relatively the same time. The more of these we can get into clinical trials, the better chance we have of finding a vaccine that's going to be effective. And so I think seeing these vaccines being developed is a great reason for hope.
Dr. Louis Phalo, chair of the Department of Dermatology at the University of Pittsburgh and co-author of the new paper about a potential COVID-19 vaccine. Actually, it's a patch. Dr. Phalo, thanks and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
There are now more than 6,500 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the state of Georgia. The city of Macon is about 80 miles outside of Atlanta, and journalist and university instructor Sonia Green lives there. She has asthma and has been staying home for a few weeks now, well before the governor issued that shelter-in-place order last week. Hi, Sonia.
Hi, how are you?
I am great. Thank you for being here. So these shelter-in-place orders are now in effect in Georgia, but up until a few days ago, folks really didn't have clear directives. Lots of people were out and about. Give us a sense of what it's like there now and the messages you're hearing.
It's really interesting. Yeah, the shelter-in-place just took place last week, and that really, I mean, you kind of see a little bit of turn of the tide. I use Instacart right now for my grocery shopping, and people are taking it more seriously. The shelves are getting, you know, a little more empty, so people are maybe stocking up and shopping more because of the shelter in place. But prior to that, there was really not a sense that people were necessarily doing that. But I will say there's also a lot of mixed messaging happening in Georgia, too, because just as quickly as the shelter in place was put in place, the governor also reopened beaches. And that's mm-hmm. been, you know, on the whisper network, if you will. We've heard of, you know, crowds still forming at beaches and things of that nature. So it still feels like there is some mixed messaging, which might influence how seriously people take the order. But there does seem to be a little bit of,
shift.
There is a sense that people, have made a little shift. Yeah.
You mentioned the mixed messaging from the governor and other officials. What are you most concerned about for Macon and really the state of Georgia right now?
I am really concerned that there is not a sense that we're all in this together and that what's happening in one county is going to impact what's happening in the county, you know, one over. There's been, you know, not really great communication from the public hospital here. And so that's been challenging. Like some hospitals are putting out daily updates and kind of letting people know at least twice a day, almost, you know, about, you know, how many people are coming in and getting tested, how many are positive, how many beds, all of these things that we really don't have a lot of information about. And so I think mm-hmm. that also kind of creates a little bit of a bubble for people thinking that maybe it's not as bad as, you know, people say it is, or as, you know, the media, as people love to say it is. So it does worry me that I don't think that there is a real sense of like people collectively understanding, you know, what the impact of it is. It just doesn't seem to be a shift towards that understanding.
That's Sonia Green, a journalist and instructor at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia. Sonia, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Many manufacturers are now changing course to meet the urgent demand for protective gear for healthcare workers. This need, as we've been hearing, is especially critical in New York City. Gwen Hogan from member station WNYC reports.
Within 72 hours, Michael Bednark flipped his entire business from one that builds large custom marketing displays for companies like Google and Heineken to one that mass produces a single item.
Basically, all it is a piece of clear plastic, a piece of foam, and a piece of elastic. Three pieces, you can assemble it and cut it within under 4 minutes.
They're face shields. They're used over masks to protect healthcare workers' eyes. New York City put out a clarion call to local manufacturers 2 weeks ago, and over 500 companies have responded.
They need hundreds of thousands of face masks. What can we do?
Bednark started workshopping ideas. They had a prototype in a day and met with the city's health department the next morning. By that night, the city had ordered 120,000 face shields. Behind Bednark, workers are shearing giant sheets of plastic down to size.
Time is of the essence, so we're trying to cut as many shields as we can per day.
His business, Bednark Studio, is located in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. It's a 300-acre waterfront campus where hundreds of businesses have set up shop, from movie studios to food production. During World War II, workers assembled aircraft carriers and fixed ships here. Now, an event space has been transformed into a makeshift factory floor with stunning views of the East River. It's where the face shields are being assembled.
You ready?
Yes, ready.
Everyone's temperatures are checked before entering.
You're looking great.
Inside, around 100 workers wear respirators and plastic gloves as they attach strips of foam and elastic to the face shields. One worker, 32-year-old Ernesto Howard, was recently laid off from a music studio when the state ordered all non-essential businesses to close.
Yeah, it feels great. We're hoping to close. It's a tough situation, and everyone just has to step up.
Mike Barra, a 51-year-old Staten Island resident, said he, too, was just furloughed from his job and wasn't sure what he'd do.
I wondered myself, honestly. My family's home. My wife has asthma, so I got to be super careful not to bring anything home. But I felt like I should be here.
Several other businesses in the Navy Yard have also switched their operations to help the city. A perfumery and a distillery are now making hand sanitizer. A tailoring business has started sewing face masks. During World War II, the Navy Yard earned the nickname the Can-Do Yard. And workers here suspect it may earn it again in the coming days and weeks. For NPR News, I'm Gwen Hogan in New York.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
So many of us are grappling with the slew of deaths from COVID-19. My family knows 7 people who have died, and for us and everyone else, there'll be no traditional wakes, no funerals, no memorials, burial, or church ceremonies. Most of us have never experienced anything like this in our lives. So how do we begin to grieve and make sense of this new reality? For more, we're joined by Brandi Scalace. She's the author of Death's Summer Coat, What the History of Death and Dying Teaches Us About Life and Living. Welcome.
Thank you.
I was reading an article where a funeral home worker in Milan, Italy said, quote, "This pandemic kills twice. First, it isolates you from your loved ones right before you die. Then it doesn't allow anyone to get closure." And that really hit me hard. It really struck me and made me think, like, have we ever experienced anything like this on such a large scale?
We have, but it has been a long time ago. I think a lot of people are referring to the Spanish flu of 1918, which swept across internationally. But in the West, particularly, this is new for us. We haven't seen something like this in a long time. And I think the last one in recent memory might have been polio, but of course that was very different. It tended to affect only children, and so you didn't have that sense that no one could contact anyone.
You've actually said that specifically here in the United States, we are psychologically unprepared to address or handle death, and that this is the real crisis that we're dealing with right now. What do you mean?
I feel that we're victims of our own success at times, and here in the United States, with the advent of modern medicine and modern science and technology, things like ventilators, which are now in short supply, we just got used to the idea that you get sick and then you get better and you go to the hospital and then you come home. And the fact that we are really divorced in some ways from the death and dying experience, other cultures are much closer to, for instance, if you are going to wash the body or you're going to have the person dying in their home with you, there's a nearness, there's a sense that you're part of that entire journey of mortality. And here, death is often mitigated by a kind of sterility. So you have the hospital and then the funeral home, and many people see their loved ones alive in the hospital and then not again until the funeral home. And so there's a disconnection, partly because we've been so successful at eradicating disease, wow, at stopping infection.
But you bring up that process, that tradition then of the funeral home and being able to have a wake or a funeral. Can you talk a little bit, though, about that act of physically coming together to mourn or comfort and how we really don't have that in this particular pandemic?
So one of the things I like to remind us all about is that we're very story-related creatures. We're narrative creatures. And how we make meaning in our lives and also in death is through story. And story can be ritual or ritual can be story. It depends on how you want to look at it. But that allows us to process. You know, we use our words. And often we go to these funerals, and what does everyone do? They share stories about the person that has died. So that memorializing process, that closure, partly comes about by you reimagining their life.
I'm thinking about the other things, though, that we are now missing during this pandemic. You know, in my family, when someone dies, I'm thinking about the food. People from all over, friends who were friends from 20, 30 years ago, bringing a dish to the house and just sitting with the loved ones, not even with the person perhaps at a wake, but with the loved ones. That is now gone. What can we do to still grieve and pay our respects without these rituals?
We can look at the way death has been translated by other cultures. And I like to use the Khmer Rouge, the Pol Pot regime. They killed many people in Cambodia. There's mass graves. But this is a really interestingly resilient society in terms of how they mourn. Because they feel it's necessary to chant over a body in order to help that soul on its way. And obviously, if you're having mass, you know, disappearances and people being buried en masse, you can't do that in an individual way. So what they did is as a community, as a religious community and as a culture, they instituted a new way of grieving, which allowed you to take things that belonged to the person, photographs, clothing, jewelry, articles, and chant over those things. So it was a kind of replacement. But they basically blessed the experience sort of retrospectively using new ways. And to me, that represents the real strength of what ritual and storytelling can do in the face of grief, is that if we don't have a story that works for us right now, we do have the power to make new ones.
And in the moment, we have technology that allows us to come together and be able to have these memorials through a Zoom call or through a phone call.
Absolutely. And I think that we're sometimes really still quite focused on how do I make the funeral an online event, when I would suggest how do we make our grief something that can be shared digitally. And it doesn't necessarily mean replicating or recreating exactly what might have happened in a funeral home, but thinking beyond that to the art, science, audio, visual possibilities that we have to express our magnitude of feeling for this person. And in some ways, because it is digital, it's also shareable outside the moment of the funeral, outside of your immediate circle as well. So I'd say right now we're looking toward a future where death will have touched everyone. And so I would almost encourage us to think more broadly about how we can connect not just to our immediate loved ones, but to other people who are suffering the same kind of dissonance as a result.
That's Brandi Scalace, PhD and author of Death's Summer Coat, What the History of Death and Dying Teaches Us About Life and Living. Brandi, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me on.
Musicians and other performers are among those hit hard by the economic effects of this coronavirus. For many, most of their income opportunities have been canceled or delayed indefinitely. NPR's Anastasia Tsiolkas reports that many musicians are now trying their hand at teaching online.
Bassist Steve Whipple has played with everyone from Lady Gaga to NEA Jazzmaster Toshiko Akiyoshi to his own group. As soon as the coronavirus started making its way across the United States, Whipple saw that musicians were getting in trouble. Tours were shut down. Venues started closing left and right.
A lot of people are stuck at home, so I thought if we could connect those two populations, you know, it would help employ the musicians who don't have work.
So he and a couple of friends set up a website called Maestro Match to pair up teachers with prospective students around the globe, both kids and adults. Within days, hundreds of musicians had signed up to teach, from emerging artists to world-famous professionals.
Some of my heroes are signing up to teach. I've been kind of blown away with the name. So, I mean, it's really hurting every level of musician, you know.
While some musicians are racing to play catch-up, learning how to use video conferencing apps and figuring out how to accept payment electronically, others are old hands, like flutist and educator Barbara Cecil. Cecil's been teaching online for years. Coincidentally, most of her students are from one country that's been deeply affected by the coronavirus crisis.
I teach a lot of students from China because there are a lot of high-level students who want to go to American universities and graduate schools.
Cecil says she's learned that while there are some drawbacks to interacting with her students online, she's mostly found it to be really positive.
Working with somebody online is really focused. I can see everything they're doing because they're like right in front of my face, and I can't get distracted, and they can't either.
Other musicians worry there's simply too much competition right now to really make any money.
It's a flooded market with online teaching at the moment, and we haven't necessarily seen any increase in prospective students.
Chris King is a trumpet player from Orlando, Florida. He gigs around the city and also works at the Disney theme parks. They're closed now, so he's telling his colleagues to look outside of music to make their monthly nut.
Whatever skill you have, by all means, this is probably the time to try and cash in a little bit on it.
Like landscaping or repairing instruments, whatever keeps the money coming in. But singer-songwriter Amy Spies says making music online is exactly the right thing to be doing for both teachers and students.
I know one thing that heals people is working on the thing that they love, even if it's not their job. And if you're stuck at home, why not work on songs? Why not work on songwriting?
Nothing good could come from this. Can we pull back and take it slow?
Spies lives in Nashville. She says people are anxious and they're already getting stir crazy. So she's been offering group songwriting workshops online. They've been filling up, and not just with professional musicians.
Waiters, bartenders, service people who are stuck at home wondering, they want to create something because they've got to put their feelings somewhere. Because if your feelings stay in your head, what are you going to do? You're going to drink, take drugs. So I feel like that's my job as an artist and now as a teacher to help those who want to express this and give them some tools and allow them a space that there's a community around them that can support them.
Spies says making art and music together, even virtually, is exactly the balm people need right now. Anastasia Tsoulkas, NPR News, New York.
Nothing safe here, nothing sound. And keep the train along the track. There's still time to turn around. As if we don't know turning back. Or kick wide open that same door.
As countries struggle to deal with the health and economic consequences of the coronavirus pandemic, cybersecurity experts are warning it could take a toll on computer systems. Think about it. Companies that usually handle sensitive information in their offices are telling employees to work from home. And as Callum Borges from member station WBUR reports, that can make them more vulnerable to hackers, especially if they're browsing websites they wouldn't visit if they were in the office.
You probably know digital acronyms like LOL and OMG, and maybe even NSFW. That's not safe for work, and it's a warning for, well, let's just say it, porn. Porn is one of hackers' favorite tools, and it may be more effective if a company's employees decide what's not safe for work is safe for working from home during the coronavirus outbreak.
I mean, adult sites have always been like in the top three categories of websites hosting malicious content.
This is Tyler Moffitt. He's the senior threat researcher at the cybersecurity firm Webroot.
So yeah, I would say that that is a reasonable assumption that we're going to see an increase due to porn at home. You know, these cyber criminals, they're seizing on this opportunity during a difficult time of quarantine and pandemic outbreak.
The website Pornhub says traffic is indeed spiking during the outbreak. But virtual voyeurs are not the only ones at risk of being hacked. The simple act of working at home can put a target on your back, says Tom Kellerman. He's the head of cybersecurity strategy at the software company VMware.
There has been a dramatic increase of cybercrime and cyber attacks over the past 2 weeks targeting Americans. As the greater hacker community of the world appreciates that Americans are now working outside of their corporate firewalls.
Kellerman notes corporate firewalls can extend to workers' homes through VPNs. Those are virtual private networks that some companies have designed to make remote work more secure. Still, hackers can prey on fear and desperation, says Peter Bauer. He's the CEO of Mimecast.
We're seeing things like scams going out via email that are posing as Costco, luring people in to be able to stock up on emergency things.
Hackers don't really want to sell you toilet paper and Purell, obviously. Watch out, too, for emails purporting to be from the federal government, offering coronavirus relief checks if only you'll share your bank info. Bauer points out that some hackers may be more active now because they're feeling desperate, too. He says many have day jobs, or at least did before the outbreak.
And I dare say there are an awful lot of attackers whose own daily lives have been interrupted, and they're spending a lot more time sitting behind computers, trying to figure out how to make their money that way.
Bauer predicts aggressive hacking efforts will continue for at least a few more weeks. There's no perfect defense against these attacks, but workers can lower their risk by practicing something called
digital hygiene.
This is Andy Ellis, Chief Security Officer of Akamai Technologies.
At the same time that every time you walk into the bathroom, you should wash your hands for 20 seconds and scrub, and you take that good time, you need to do the same thing when you're working in the electronic world.
Ellis says good digital hygiene can include cleaning old documents out of your Dropbox or Google Drive so they're not just sitting there if your account is compromised. It can also include staying off porn sites. For NPR News, I'm Callum Borchers.
Have you also been thrown back to middle school, learning about the Middle Ages and the Knights of the Round Table and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight and, oh yeah, the bubonic plague, waves of infection that killed a third of the European population with outbreaks for centuries, one in 1564 in Stratford-upon-Avon, England. The town records there record a weaver's apprentice death with the words, "Hic incipit pestis, here begins the plague." And there, a young couple barricaded themselves in their home. The Black Death had already killed two of their children. They wanted to try to save their three-month-old, William. William Shakespeare. His life would be shaped by plague. In 1606, when there was another outbreak and Shakespeare was 42, everything, including London's Globe Theater, was shut down. He hunkered down and wrote three epics, King Lear, Macbeth, and Antony and Cleopatra. Joining us now to talk Shakespeare and the plague, James Shapiro, who teaches English and comparative literature at Columbia University and is author of the new book, Shakespeare in a Divided America. And Professor James, you know, this is a frightening, terrible time, but we have to remind ourselves we are not yet loading bodies onto horse-drawn carts. You know, this is not the Middle Ages where they had no medicine, but still, are you finding your students thinking about plague in this time?
One of them is recovering from coronavirus. 16 days later, he still looks pretty beat up. Mm-hmm. So, no, we're not having plague carts and plague burial pits, but I'm speaking to you from New York City. Elmhurst Hospital in Queens has a refrigerator truck outside piling up bodies. So it's not as bad as it was, and I do hope that it gets better. But, yes, Shakespeare has been there before us in this way, as in so many others.
Well, let's talk about what he did. Romeo and Juliet, for instance. People might forget how plague played a role in that terrible outcome of their love story. I mean, we remember maybe Mercutio saying, "A plague on both your houses," but there really was a plague on them.
It's something that Shakespeare added to his source materials. You had mentioned in your introduction that a plague had struck London in 1606. There had been an enormously powerful plague that struck London in 1593, a year or so before he wrote Romeo and Juliet. The theaters were closed for 14 months or so. 10,000 Londoners died, maybe one out of every seven living in the city at the time. So when Shakespeare writes Romeo and Juliet in the immediate aftermath of that plague and describes a scene in which Friar John is sent to deliver a message to Romeo, and that message can't get there because Friar John is suspected of having been in an infected house and he is quarantined, so unable to carry that message to Romeo, that would have been lived experiences for Londoners just coming out of what I hope will be coming out of quite soon, but a far more lethal pandemic.
Well, and to remind people, Juliet has a fake death, and then this letter doesn't get delivered to Romeo telling him that because his Friar John says, I was in the house where the infectious pestilence did reign. And so yes. I still have the letter. It doesn't get to Romeo. Oh, no. So Romeo has killed himself. And then Juliet, finding out that he has, she kills herself. This would have been very powerful for that audience.
I think quite terrifying, all the more so because Shakespeare and his fellow playwrights almost never wrote about the plague. People died in all kinds of ways in Shakespeare's plays. Nobody ever dies of plague. It's just taboo. So the few times that he does mention plague, mostly in his tragedies, it hits with incredible force.
Yeah. Because we were reminded that probably people didn't want to go to the theater to hear about the thing that was frightening them. So in order, if he was going to use it, it would have to be, you know, as a knowing, powerful tool. It reminds us now, you know, artists are probably working on different things while they're sequestered. But I don't know if people are going to want to see a story about a virus.
I doubt that anyone, maybe we'll be writing about it in our diaries, and I'm sure a lot of artists are doing that. But it'll be a while before I think we'll go to movies about pandemics again.
Yeah. Talk about another play, which you've written about in a book called The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606, the year that we spoke of in which he was hunkering down and writing. That is, you know, something to be said of this time, that a great artist like Shakespeare could write one of the greatest plays in literature in that terrible year. How do you think it affected how he shaped King Lear?
We think Shakespeare is extraordinary in a lot of ways, but one of the things that we might understand better right now is from 1603, when perhaps the worst outbreak in his lifetime struck London and killed over a fifth of his fellow Londoners in that year, up to 1610, plague came back again and again, so that Shakespeare's greatest plays are all written in the shadow of, or during, or in the immediate aftermath of plague. And I'm thinking of King Lear and Macbeth and Antony and Cleopatra and Coriolanus, Timon of Athens. These plays really bear the mark of living through such a terrible experience. And it may well be that his move towards writing tragedy at this time is a kind of response to the tragedy that his society was experiencing in these years.
Well, we just saw Glenda Jackson take on the role of King Lear on Broadway, had this incredible conversation with her. But I'm thinking now of, you know, Lear out on the heath. He's going crazy. He's made mistakes. He's been paranoid. He hasn't trusted his children. And, you know, this was an embattled man. I mean, maybe not sheltering in place, but kind of stuck in a metaphorical mental prison.
Lear is changed in the course of the play. And Lear, at his worst, curses his eldest daughter with the kind of claim that must have been excruciating to hear when he says to Goneril earlier in the play, "Thou art my flesh, my blood, my daughter," or rather a disease that lies within my flesh, which I must needs call mine. "Thou art a bile, a plague sore, an embossed carbuncle in my corrupted blood." Mm. which is as terrible a thing as you could say to another person during a time, a period of plague. So when he is transformed in the course of his experience in the play and says, as a ruler of his country, looking at those suffering, I have taken too little care of this. And it may be too much to hope that our national leaders and international leaders right now may have a similar response, feel that they too have taken too little care of the social problems that are under the magnifying glass right now.
Hmm. Professor, what other lines can we be thinking of? Here in this time, even though this is, again, such a frightening time, we're seeing the pictures that are coming out of, as you said, New York and crowded emergency rooms. But we're not, most of us are spared. Fewer and fewer of us will be spared. We know that. But most of us are spared, really looking this current plague in the face. Just where else can we look in Shakespeare to see how, you know, people recoiled from it?
I would say when I look at Shakespeare in this situation, what strikes me most is he didn't flee. He stayed in place in London and understood that as an artist, his role, his job, so to speak, was to help people when they came out of these terrible periods, when the theaters reopened, and that his works were there to give them comfort and clarity. And I'm involved with a lot of theater companies. A lot of things are on hold right now. I do know that when we come out on the other side of this, we're going to need theater and we're going to need Shakespeare, and it'll be there for us.
That's James Shapiro. He teaches English and comparative literature at Columbia University, is author of the new book Shakespeare and a Divided America, taking a look at plague through the lens that Shakespeare did. Fascinating. Professor James, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And the other thing to take from Shakespeare, it strikes me, they got through it.
Governments around the world grappling with this coronavirus outbreak are trying to figure out how and when they'll reopen their economies. President Trump famously tweeted last month, "We cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself." But what would reopening stores and schools too soon actually mean for the economy? Derek Thompson has been writing about this. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington as he does each Monday. Derek, welcome back.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yes. So the title of your article is The Four Rules of Pandemic Economics. And your first rule is that the idea of either saving the economy or saving lives is a false choice. What do you mean?
I mean that in the short term, when you have a pandemic raging, it does no good to allow people to go to restaurants and go to movies and go to concerts because they're just going to get extremely sick and have to stay home from work anyway. So indeed, it makes sense to say, look, saving the economy versus saving lives doesn't make a lot of sense because the economy is made up of living people. So what we should want to do is root out the pandemic itself, save as many people as possible, create a short and sharp recession, and then hope that we can quickly put everything back online really quickly. One metaphor that's sometimes been used is that this is a little bit like a medically induced coma. The purpose is to solve the problem the patient is facing by putting them under, fixing the problem, and then putting them back into consciousness. That's what we're trying to do right now. We're trying to deep freeze the economy with the hope of thawing it very soon thereafter.
Okay, which brings us to number two, pay people a living wage to stop working. What do economists say about whether the U.S. is doing enough to pay people to stop working?
Yeah, this is another rule that just totally flies in the face of historical macroeconomics. Typically, you would always want to make sure that everybody who wants to work can work and they're paid a living wage to do so. But in a pandemic, that logic is turned on its head. What you want people to do is to social distance. And that means if they work at concert halls or at restaurants or at churches, they should not come into work, but they also shouldn't starve. So we should pay them a living wage to stop working. We should find ways to keep them and their families healthy, even though they can't come into work. The way the U.S. has done this essentially is it's a few ways. We've made an agreement to send most households a one-time payment of about $1,200 per adult plus $500 per child. We've also beefed up unemployment benefits. I think these are both fine ideas, but it's important to note that other countries have taken a different stance. Denmark and other Northern European nations have essentially said, we're going to pay businesses to maintain their payrolls to avoid the sort of mass layoffs that we're already beginning to see in the U.S. Again, this fits with the earlier metaphor of just freezing the economy. Let's get everybody who's employed with their current employer or boss, just stay at that company. We'll pay you to do nothing for a few months. And then hopefully in the summer, we can bring the whole thing back online without having to lose millions, maybe even tens of millions of people in the U.S. to unemployment.
Yeah, you have another rule that really speaks to businesses and their plight right now. That comes from economist Justin Wolfers at the University of Michigan, who told you that you have to build companies a time machine. What does that mean?
Right. So he's not talking about the H.G. Wells contraption. He's talking about a time machine made out of money. So he put it to me this way. His local burrito shop, which used to be a thriving business, it could go belly up any day now. But in a post-pandemic world, it's going to be a thriving business again. So what that burrito business needs is really what every small and medium-sized business needs right now, actually including large businesses. They need a time machine that can move their expenses from the present day to the future. And in the U.S. economic rescue package, that time machine looks like about $350 billion in low-interest loans that the government's going to give out to small and medium-sized businesses and maybe even forgive those loans if those businesses maintain their payrolls. I think it's a good idea. I just think it's probably a little too small and a little too late. If we want to pay all the small and medium-sized businesses in the U.S. enough money to maintain their payrolls, that figure shouldn't be $350 billion. It should be closer to $600 or $700 billion.
You also say in rule number four, the business of America is now science. Can you explain that?
Sure. To summarize everything that I just said, we need to get people money or they're going to die. And we need to get companies cash or they're going to die. But if we don't clear the way for healthcare workers to treat the sick, if we don't find a way to test and trace illnesses, we don't find a way to build antiviral medications or a vaccine, if we don't fix the science problem, people and companies are going to die anyway. There's just no such thing as a normal economy until we can contain this virus. And we have to do so as soon as possible, because that means that all these rules that I've just told you about that throw economics on its head, all these pandemic economy rules, we can finally leave them in this brief period of the pandemic and move on into a post-pandemic world.
That's Derek Thompson. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. He wrote The Four Rules of Pandemic Economics. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.